But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening, from back in Annapolis, Maryland, Pastor David Whitney. And we're going to be talking this evening about the Constitution of the United States. Now, we go over this once every month with this audience for a very specific reason, and that is because the Constitution is under attack today. The problem is that the major driving force behind the leadership of both political parties is globalization, the desire to bring about a one-world government, to destroy the sovereignty of the United States, and, of course, to create a one-world religion. This is the reason for the attack on Christianity. This is why they try to take Christ out of Christmas, take God and prayer out of our classrooms, even though that they open the Supreme Court session there every day. When the choir comes in and says, God bless the United States and this honorable court, they know, of course, that God is an important part of our society, but you see, there are people who would create a one-world government and a new world order. So the only foundation we have in this country is our Constitution. We have traitors at the highest levels of government who are dedicated to the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation. And we have to understand what our Constitution says. We have to understand our form of government if we hope to preserve it. So with that as a background, Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to speak with people who care enough about their country to learn what it's going to take to take our country back, just like you said, from the globalists, the one-worlders who are seeking the destruction of our constitutional republic. We're not a democracy, as you hear repeatedly from every high official calling us a democracy. We are not. We're a constitutional republic. Our founders structured our constitution to rein in the government, that is, to set boundaries, set high, thick, designed to be impregnable walls around what the federal government could do and what it could not do. And as we have been walking through Article 1 in the past sessions, we've been looking specifically at the most important provision of the Constitution. That's Article 1, Section 8, because Article 1, Section 8 lists the powers that we, the people, that's the first phrase of the Constitution. We, the people, have delegated these specific powers to our federal government, and only these powers. In other words, this list of 18 powers in Article 1, Section 8, these are the only thing the federal government can legitimately do. If they do anything beyond what these list of 18 say they can do, they are breaking the law. As we look at this list, we see so many examples of law breaking. The entire Department of Education is against the law because it violates the structure of the Constitution that says education has no business being in the spending or oversight of the federal government. It's none of their business. That's reserved to the states or to the people, respectively, as the Ninth and Tenth Amendment point out.
And, of course, without an understanding of what our Constitution is all about, you can't understand what is really going on. Until you understand that the people who are trying to convince us we are a democracy are people who are dedicated to the destruction of our freedom. Democracy always ends up a despotism. That's why our founding fathers here in the United States gave us a republican form of government. Well, David, go ahead and pick up the story there.
We'll review some of the ones we already looked at just to remind ourselves that Section 8 begins by saying the first power is Congress can tax and spend for only three reasons: payment of debts, common defense, general welfare. Nothing else can they tax and spend for. Secondly, they can borrow money. Thirdly, regulate commerce with foreign nation and Indian tribes as well as among the several states. That's interstate commerce between states. Four, they can make rules for naturalization and bankruptcy. Five, they can coin money and regulate value, 6 weights and measures, 6 they punish counterfeiting, and 7 establish post offices and post roads. And as we mentioned, in each one of these decisions, of these 18 powers that we the people decided to grant these powers to the federal government, there was a decision made. And the decision was, is the power going to be retained by we the people, ourselves, or by our state government, or is it going to be a power given to, granted to the federal government? And basically, the decisions were only those powers that were absolutely necessary to grant to the federal government, that is, they wouldn't function well if each of the 13 states, which is what they were at that point, each of the 13 states had a different post office system and post road system. Coordinating all those wouldn't work, and therefore it would be an unwieldy thing. It would be better if that was done on the federal level. So only the things that would not be done best on the state level were granted to the federal government. In other words, it's a very limited list, as Federalist 45 says very specifically. The powers granted to the federal government are few and limited. The powers of the state governments are broad and many. Which today we have the exact opposite of the design of our founders. The powers of the federal government are nearly unlimited, and the powers of the state governments are very limited and very few.
Now let me just reiterate what David said. You need to get a copy of the Federalist Papers. You can get that through Radio Liberty. We carry that. It was written by Madison and Hamilton and Jay. And in the 45th of the Federalist Papers, really so important, the powers of the federal government are to be limited and defined. The powers of the state government are unlimited and ill-defined, and anything having to do with life and liberty and property was to be taken care of at the state level, never at the federal government level. It was never to be the function of the federal government to take care of the people, to monitor the people, to listen to their telephone calls in the name of fighting terrorism. We understand we're moving towards a dictatorship in America because there are people who have a different world vision. And, of course, terrorism is a very, very convenient excuse to justify listening to everybody's telephone calls, and that's what it's all about, not listening to terrorists. So we'll be right back. Well, this is Arthur Stan. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney, and Pastor Whitney is simply talking about what's in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, where 18 things were actually given to the federal government. Those were the only things that they could do. Anything beyond that, a usurpation of power would be a treasonous act expanding the power of government, which our founding fathers feared. So pick up the story there.
We mentioned number 7 was to establish post offices and post roads, number 8 to establish rules for copyrights and patents, 9 to establish federal courts below the Supreme Court. As we'll see when we study Article 3, the Supreme Court is the only federal court that is required by the Constitution to be in existence. All the lower courts could be abolished. They're all under the power, really, of the Congress. Number 10 was to define and punish piracy and felonies on the high seas and violations of the law of nations. Number 11 on through number 16 all deal with the provisions of war. And it's very important to see the design of our founders. They recognized there was a grave danger in putting too much power, war powers, in the hands of any one individual or any group of individuals. And so they divvied up the powers regarding war between the executive branch, where the president is the commander-in-chief of the forces, and the Congress, that the Congress has a great deal of power regarding what takes place with the military. And so these provisions, the war provisions, numbers 11 through 16 in Article 1, Section 8, are very important to understand, because what we have today, building the empire really is what our military is about, are direct violations repeatedly of the provisions here that say that Congress is to do certain things and the President to do other things. There's a division of power because they recognize that the person or the group of persons have all the power of the military in their hand. That is an extremely dangerous thing. What we've had happen, as we'll see when we look at this list, is that the powers that were granted to Congress Congress, by and large, has abdicated those powers to the president.
Well, of course, you know, David, a lot of the congressmen are afraid of the president. I mean, certainly they have had a conscious effort to go ahead and compromise many of our congressmen to get, you know, the goods on them, or if they haven't done anything wrong, to contrive evidence, as they did with Congressman George Hansen, and send him to prison and torture him for 10 years. And why? Because he was a good, honest man, and after 10 years, they said, oh, shucks, George, we're so sorry what we did to you. Well, you know, we're going to let you go, or we're going to give you a pardon, because the federal government had no right to send you to prison. Your health is destroyed. You're financially bankrupt. You know, your career is destroyed. And every congressman back there knows that they can do that to him as well. You see, once you centralize power with government, why, it will be misused. This is just the very nature of what government's about, and that's why our founding fathers were so frightened at the centralization of power and wanted to put the chains onto the government and take them off of the people. Now, the latest thing is we've seen the federal government report came out just this last week. It's called the National Strategy Report, something to that effect. Anybody'd like to know, we can get you copies of that through Radio Liberty. But here they're talking about, we have the right to attack anybody we want to. We have the right of preemptive attack to attack anyone in the world because we think they may be a threat to us. What a frightening thing. Well, what about Congress? Don't they have anything to say about it? The president has taken all power unto himself in the United States, and where is the outcry from our Christian leaders? Why, it's deafening in its silence, because so many of them are hoping they're going to get large amounts of money from the faith-based program, which, of course, is unconstitutional in itself. But, you know, there's so many of our Christian leaders who have taken large sums of money from the government, and you never hear them being critical of the government, do you?
No, and tragically, they're not encouraging the people in America, which is what their duty, their spiritual duty, should be, to encourage the people in America to study the law. Many people these days talk about, you know, we've got to uphold the rule of law. Well, what is the rule of law if those in power, the president and the Congress and the Supreme Court, break the supreme law of the land, this Constitution that we're studying? If they violate this Constitution, they are law breakers. Unfortunately, our system does not have a policing power that goes after them except we the people. It is we the people that have to hold our elected officials accountable. It's we the people that enforce the Constitution. There's no self-enforcing mechanism in the Constitution itself. It's we the people, so we must know the law and know when it's being violated and then hold our elected officials accountable when they are violating the rule of law, the true rule of law. That's the sad thing about that phrase. It's been so abused because most people think the rule of law is, well, whatever the president says it is, or whatever the Supreme Court, or whatever the Congress says, that's the rule of law. No, it's not. The rule of law is this document, because this document is Article 6, we'll see when we get there, says it is the supreme law of the land. That is, any law made that violates the Constitution or goes against the principles of the Constitution is lawless. It's no law at all. It's null and void. It's waste paper. It needs to be shredded. And the fact that Americans don't know this document, this Constitution, is the heart of the reason why we are letting them, you know, the powers that be, the tyrants that be, actually, get away with breaking the law day after day after day. And our founders must be weeping as they see they sacrifice their lives, many of them, and their fortunes to establish this constitutional republic. To see it wasted through ignorance, a small thing, through ignorance, is a tragedy indeed. But looking at the war provisions that are in the hands of Congress, this is the duty of Congress. Number 11 is to declare war. It is never in the power of the president, as a commander-in-chief, to declare war. It is only in the power of Congress to declare war. And the reason that was designed that way is they knew Congress is much more answerable to the people. They're elected, and they've got there's a smaller constituency of people that they are answerable to, unlike the president. And if the war is not what the people in America believe ought to be pursued, the Congress is going to hear about it very shortly, and they're not going to be able to conduct a war that the people in our land do not want to have conducted. However, what's taken place today is the president has basically usurped this power and said, well, you know, you just give me an authorization to use force, I guess is the phrase they've used. So Congress gave him an authorization to use force. Well, there's nowhere in the Constitution where they have the power to delegate away that power which has been delegated to them. We, the people, did not delegate that to the president. We delegated it to the Congress for a very important reason. So the power to declare war is Congress's. They have not declared war since World War II. That was the last constitutionally legitimate war that our country was engaged in. All the conflicts since then, Vietnam, Korea, just to go on the list, Gulf I and now Gulf II, all of them are unconstitutional. All of them are a violation of the law by Congress, by the President, and by, you could say, the Supreme Court as well, by not holding, the Supreme Court should be holding these other two branches accountable, saying what you're doing is against the Constitution, it's lawless, and you need to change your evil ways. So number 11 is to declare war. Number 12 is to raise and support armies. And, of course, armies is really a generic term for all non-naval forces. It's broad enough to include the Air Force, actually. The Air Force was, in part of the Army originally and so on. And there's a two-year limitation in this power that's granted to Congress. There's a two-year limitation on the funding. So the idea is that armies were always to be temporary. There was never to be a standing army. Our founders feared a standing army, rightly so, because they had suffered under the jackbooted heels of the Redcoats. They knew what a standing army, what a great evil a standing army was, and that when an empire has a standing army sitting around, it's going to use that standing army to do what? Expand the empire. So they wanted no standing army. They wanted a two-year reauthorization of any spending for military activity if an army had been raised, so that it was very accountable to the people.
Let me just intercede for just a minute. I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that the United States spends more money for its military than the next 20 nations in the world. In fact, it's said that the United States spends more money on its military than all of the rest of the world combined, and I really think that's not too far off the track. What is this really all about? I mean, why do we have to have such a powerful military? Oh, we've got to, of course, defend ourselves against the communists. At least that's what they told us for many years, but they never mentioned that our banks and our corporations were actually funding the communists, so we would have an enemy to justify massive increase in government power over our lives. Now, of course, we have the threat of the terrorists, the wicked Islamic terrorists. That's why we have to have such a powerful military. No, the powerful military is really so we can accomplish the ultimate goal, which is world government, an American empire, and whether we will rule it or whether it will be ruled by the United Nations, I think it's going to be ruled by the Antichrist when this world government comes along. But the major thrust of American foreign policy is establishing a world government, and they're using the financial and military power of the United States to accomplish that goal. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes. Oh, most definitely, because the change from the constitutional structure that was laid down by our founding fathers really did not take place until this century. Like I said, the last constitutionally declared war was World War II, which, as you know, is part of the plan in moving our country towards being a pawn, really, in the New World Order, and as you say, I believe rightly, in the kingdom of Antichrist that ultimately he's going to establish in this world with absolute dictatorship, total tyranny, no one has freedom, everyone is a slave, and that's where we're headed. Unless we rise up, unless we resist, and then that evil kingdom may be delayed.
And that's our job, is first to educate people about what's happening. And you can't understand what's happening and what's wrong with what's happening unless you understand we are not a democracy, contrary to what George Bush says and Al Gore and all of them have said. They lie to you. You were taught this is a democracy. It's not. We are a republic. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and for those of you who've never read my little pamphlet, We Are a Republic, it really is a good summary of this. And, of course, what you're going to learn from the Institute of the Constitution will, of course, reinforce this whole idea. Our founding fathers created a republic. Their idea was to take the chains off of the people and put the chains onto government. However, there are people in Washington, D.C. who have an entirely different agenda. They want to take the chains off of government and put them on the people, and they are actually setting up detention camps all over America. Halliburton was recently given almost $300 or $400 million to begin building those detention camps, and they already have many of them, but they want more in case of civil unrest, or maybe we'll put the illegal aliens there, or, ladies and gentlemen, there are people who want a dictatorship in America. And because they do not believe in the Constitution, and they are using the threat of Islamic terrorism or of illegal immigration or some threat or not to justify massive expansion of the power of government over the lives of our people. Go ahead, David.
Well, the second, or that was number 12, to raise and support armies is the power that Congress has. 13 is to provide and maintain a navy. You see, a navy is a more permanent force. You just can't overnight say, okay, we're going to put together these ships and put them out to sea. A navy has to be maintained in an ongoing basis. Therefore, the funding for a navy needed to be something continual, and the sailors and officers needed to be maintained on a continuing basis. Number 14 on the list of 18 is that Congress was to provide and develop the rules of discipline for the military forces. This is known as the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It is the responsibility of Congress to do that, not the president. So you remember hearing all this hue and cry during the reign, and I think that's the best term for most presidents' time in office, their reign, or is it their regime, of Clinton, that, the whole don't ask, don't tell policy about sodomites in the military. Well, what business was it for the president to establish that rule? That is none of his business. That is the business of Congress to establish how those sodomites would be treated if they were discovered in the military. And actually, the military Uniform Code of Military Justice was very clear as to how they were to be treated. But the Commander-in-Chief, Clinton, overruled the Constitution and violated the Constitution, and again, the Congress let him get away with that, rather than saying, no, the practice in the military must abide by the rules that we, Congress, have established, known as the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But most Americans thought, oh, hey, he's the Commander-in-Chief, he's the one that calls the shots for the troops. False, wrong understanding, again, a dangerous idea, because our founders knew that you do not give that power to one man in the position of president. That is a very dangerous thing. And, of course, as they were developing the Constitution, they all had clearly in their mind who they intended to be the first president. George Washington, General George Washington. They knew his character. They knew that he was perhaps the only military leader in the history of the world that did not take undue advantage of his power after victory in taking over and declaring himself king. He could have, many Americans would have wanted him to be king, but they knew they could trust him. They knew that as president, it was he was the president, actually, the congressional convention, I mean, the constitutional convention, as they were meeting and discussing all this. So he was right there hearing these discussions.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David just picked up the story right there.
Well, and so they had in mind who the first president was going to be. George Washington. If there was anyone they could trust with military power, they would trust George Washington. But they did not want to do that. They understood that it was dangerous to put too much power in the hands of the president, or else they knew that the president ultimately would become a dictator. Well, number 15 in the list is to provide for calling militia into federal service. And there's only three reasons that militia could be called into federal service. By the way, we need to be reminded that the militia was controlled and governed by the states. Each state had their own militia. Today it's called the National Guard. That's a mistake. It should be called the state militia of New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, Tennessee, 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 Tennessee Jersey, the state militia of California, and so on, it should not be called the National Guard, because they're not nationalized, they're not brought into federal service except under three specific conditions. In other words, there's no standing army. The states maintain a militia, that is, they train and they drill their people and establish officers, and they, but they're not, that's not their full-time job. They're just called up to train and be ready at a moment's notice, but they're not, that's not their full-time job as army workers. No, their job has, in the civilian force, they're a militia called into federal service for three reasons. One, to execute federal laws. Of course, federal laws that are only in concert with the Constitution. And then secondly, to suppress insurrection. That is, when the people rise up and violate the Constitution in some way, shape, or form. And there were incidents that took place between the end of the War for Independence and the Constitutional Convention, such as Shays Rebellion and Whiskey Rebellion and so forth, that gave an example of what could happen if a particular state does not have enough of militia power on its own to suppress an insurrection within its own borders. It may need the help of other state militias to do so. So that's the second reason a militia can be called into federal service. The third is to repel invasions. Well, as you know, Dr. Stan, we've got a huge, massive, unprecedented invasion coming across our southern border. And nothing is being done by the federal government. They're purposely, as we know, sitting on their hands because they want that invasion to take place. But that is a violation of the very purpose for which our Constitution was designed, to protect and defend our borders. That's what the whole purpose of calling a militia into federal service was about. You look at those three things, and everything the military is doing today is a violation of those three principles.
And yet, of course, the president justifies our presence in Iraq because, of course, we're bringing democracy there. Mm-hmm. And he justifies going to war, you know, by the fact that, well, Saddam Hussein was a wicked ruler, and there's no question he was. And there was oppression of the Iraqi people, and there's no question there was. But he does not have the right to do that under our Constitution. And the Congress did not have the right to give him the permission to do that. And we should simply vote out of office every single congressman and every single senator who voted to give him that power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where is the outcry from them now? Why they're, well, the Republicans are all rallying behind him. I'm a lifelong Republican, but what they're doing is wrong. And I will say that there's at least some of the, a few of the Democrats have the courage to do what's right, but what people don't understand is the leadership of the Democrat Party is going right along with the leadership of the Republican Party. Because they understand this has nothing to do with democracy. It has to do with globalization. And as Michael Adeen said, and Michael Adeen is one of the major architects of what's going on over there, in an article on the 30th of October 2001, Michael Adeen said, the pursuit of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden is just the first in a great salvo first shot in a salvo which is determined to transform the Middle East. And that's really what it's all about. We're trying to transform the Middle East. That's why we're going to war with Iran and Syria, if we can't overthrow the government there. Until the American people understand it has nothing to do with oil, it has nothing to do with finance, it has to do with this idea of the world government. And when you understand that, everything makes sense.
And so those three reasons, execute federal laws, suppress insurrections, repel invasions, are the only thing the military is given the power to do. Things they're doing over there in the Philippines, helping with the mudslide, that's completely bogus. That's completely a violation of the Constitution. It's a waste of taxpayers' dollars. And we need to call upon our congressmen and senators to return and obey the Constitution, because that's the law of the land. And if they will not obey it, we need to replace them with those who will obey the law of the land. If we the people have to obey the law, why shouldn't those we elect into office obey the law as well?
Well, there'd be no problem with immigration if the federal government would enforce the law. And it is a federal crime to knowingly employ people who are illegal aliens. And what are we doing? Well, we're ignoring that law. Why? That way we can encourage them to come in and, of course, create a multicultural, multilingual society. That's what it's really about. Well, this is Dr. Sten. Go ahead and pick up the story there, David.
Okay, that was number 15, provide and call for a militia in the federal service. 16 is to organize, arm, and discipline the militia. Congress controls the militia only while it's in federal service, even though they set the rules of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The states, you see, reserve the right to appoint militia officers, subject, of course, to the discipline of Congress, but the states really are in control of those militias. That's how it's designed to take place. And, of course, most states, their National Guard, they have very little say about what happens to it. It's all handed down from the feds and or from the executive branch, which is, again, a violation of the design of our founders. Number 17, stepping away now from the military or the war provisions powers granted to Congress, number 17 is that Congress was to control the District of Columbia and other federal property. First, just a comment about controlling the District of Columbia. I believe it's still the murder capital of the United States and perhaps of the world. It's one of the more dangerous places that you can go and travel through. I occasionally go down there, and I'd be very careful about what areas of Washington, D.C. you travel in, because it's an extremely dangerous city. Congress isn't controlling and managing the District of Columbia, so how in the world do they think they're going to control and manage anything else around the world? But nonetheless, they barge forward with the hubris that they think they know best. Well, in their own backyard, it's extremely dangerous. The second thing we want to notice here is that only the District of Columbia and other federal property. We've mentioned this before, I believe, that the only legitimate federal-owned property was the territories, the District of Columbia, and forts and magazines and shipyards, things necessary to provide for the Navy, things necessary to be able to raise and support armies. Those are the only legitimate federal properties. They have no business owning national parks, national forests, and all the other national monuments. The list goes on and on of things, especially out west. 90%+ of Alaska is owned by the federal government. What business do they have owning ANWR and telling the people of Alaska they cannot drill oil on that land? The federal government has no business owning that land. It is not theirs. It belongs to the sovereign state of Alaska, i.e. to the people of Alaska, to use and determine how they wish. Now, people say, well, you know, David, I like the national park system. You know, I go out and visit Yellowstone. It's a wonderful place. And so, well, you might like it, but it would be proper. It would be lawful.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. State. Well, this is Dr. Sten. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney, and he was just saying that, you know, a lot of people are confused by the state parks, by the federal parks, and they say, look, the federal parks are beautiful. What's wrong with federal parks? Well, there's nothing wrong with the parks. It's the fact that they're federal parks and that there is no authorization in the Constitution for federal parks. Now, if you like federal parks, why don't you just set up a system and amend the Constitution so this could be done. But of course, they don't want to amend the Constitution. Gee, they look so beautiful. Fine, we'll have the state parks. But this is not a function of the federal government to be controlling anything, because once we let them get away with violating the Constitution on one issue, they're going to violate it on every issue, which is exactly what they're doing. And where is the outcry from the people? There isn't any, because they don't understand the basic principle that you never allow the expansion of federal power. Otherwise, of course, it's sort of like, you know, just letting the camel get the nose under the edge of the tent, and pretty soon, why, you're on the outside and the camel's sleeping in the tent, and that's what's happened to our freedom.
Well, you know, many ranchers out west understand what this looks like, and it's really ugly when it comes up real close to them. Bureau of Land Management, a federal agency, which is an illegitimate agency, the federal government has no power to regulate and control land. That's not their business. It's not their power. It's not in this list of 18 things in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. But the Federal Bureau of Land Management is driving people off the land they have grazed their cattle on for decades, some even for a century. Many of the western states came in with an agreement, unconstitutional agreement, by the way, that the federal government could control large tracts of land with the understanding that those lands would be available for the ranchers, that they would be able to graze their cattle on this. So that was an agreement back when many of these states came into the Union. But the federal government had no business even setting up an agreement like that to begin with, and now the evil of it is beginning to be realized by people who are dependent on the land out west, because they are having their use of the land restricted and controlled as we move towards the tyranny that the New World Order wants to design. That is, it wants to put all the people in cages, restricted zones where you can live, human habitation settlements, whatever they call them. It's a UN design, UN Agenda 21, and allow all the animals to be free. So it's a reverse zoo. The humans in the cages and the animals wander free in these vast tracts. And so what they're moving towards doing piece by piece is taking control of every open space that they've designated to be rewilded and driving the people off of those land, driving the cattle, driving any human touching of those properties off the land. And that's all part of, again, their way of controlling human population, to get people just in little human settlements where they can absolutely control their movements and everything about their life, and vast stretches of land will be just left untouched by any humans. And so this evil plan is, you know, has gotten away, gotten so far along today because we the people have allowed the federal government to violate this section, Article 1, Section 8, Section 17 that talks about, or Clause 17 that talks about, the control of the District of Columbia and other federal property is the only power granted to Congress. Now, territories fall into this. So in other words, Puerto Rico is a territory, or Virgin Islands, there's territories. So whenever a new territory is being settled and developed, Congress has say over what happens in that territory. But once that territory votes and becomes a state, establishes its own constitution, it becomes its own state. Congress should have no power over any of the land in that state unless forts, magazines, naval installations, or that sort of thing. Well, number 18, the last of the powers granted to Congress, is, again, one of the most abused and misinterpreted aspects of the Constitution. It says that Congress may do what may be necessary and proper to carry out the foregoing powers and other powers granted to Congress. Often today this is seen as the elastic clause because people believe it expands federal power. That is not the original design of the Constitution. It was to be, anything that Congress was to be doing was limited to only that which was absolutely necessary and that which was proper, that which was fitting to carry out the delegated powers listed here, the other 17 powers. Well, that began to change in a Supreme Court case very early on, 1819, a case called McCulloch v. Maryland. And here, the redefinition of the word necessary was brought into bear, and this is what the Supreme Court does so many times in their evil opinions. They redefine words from what the original intent of the word was when the founders drafted and wrote it into our Constitution. McCulloch v. Maryland said, well, necessary just means what's reasonably suited, not what's absolutely indispensable. That's a redefinition of that word that vastly expanded the powers of our federal government. The other statement, or the other word, proper, they said, well, it just means that which is not forbidden by other provisions of the Constitution. That's, again, not the original intent of the founders. They wanted it to be very strictly limited to only that which they had granted to Congress in the other 17 statements. Nothing more. Well, that's Section 8, one of the most important and one of the most vital aspects for every citizen to understand. Let's step on to Section 9, because while Section 8 speaks about the powers of Congress, Section 9 then talks about the limitations on congressional authority, the first of which is they could not forbid slave trade before the year 1808, 20 years after the Constitution was signed. And the idea was that they all believed slavery was a dying institution. Give it 20 years and it will be gone. Well, things changed with the invention of the cotton gin and all that turned around, and it was not what they expected. But Congress had no power to forbid slave trade before 1808, It said nothing about slave ownership. And so the war between the states, or the war of northern aggression, whichever you might prefer to call it, basically saying, well, Lincoln claimed that, you know, it was about slavery. It wasn't about slavery at all. It was about establishing an all-powerful federal government, which is what Lincoln's vision was. But he had no power, no power, according to the Constitution, to forbid slavery as an institution. That was something the states were to deal with. And if you don't like slavery, fine. You can change the law in your own state. But the federal government was never granted power to end slavery. It could only forbid slave trade at that point. Secondly, a limitation on congressional authority is it could not suspend the writ of habeas corpus. This is a legal document demanding that the government either give a legitimate reason for imprisoning a person or let that person go. In other words, if some, police officer comes and arrests you, puts you in prison, but doesn't tell you the charges listed against you, they don't tell you why you were arrested, they don't tell you what you're being held for, what you're being tried for, you can have a writ of habeas corpus issued that demands the government either release you from prison or state the exact legitimate legal reasons why they are imprisoning you, the charges listed against you. In other words, you just can't throw people in prison for political incorrect views and keep them there to rot forever.
But I guess that's what we've done with Padilla. That is what President Bush has done.
Yes.
He is an American citizen. He may be a really bad guy. He may be a criminal intent. He may even have been working with a terrorist. But he had the right to be brought to trial. And instead, they kept him salted away for over 3 years. And then they brought him up when, of course, the judges says you've got to give this man a right to trial. Then they changed all the charges against him. Obviously, they lied to the American people about his being involved with a plot to set off a dirty bomb. Oh, we can't bring that out because we don't want Osama bin Laden to know what we knew before the 9-1-1 attack. Most of this happened before 9-1-1. So how did they know what Padilla was involved in before 9-1-1 if we couldn't infiltrate the Islamic movement? Oh, well, some of those people who were involved with him are dead or... Yeah, it's all a lie, ladies and gentlemen, but because we let them get away with what they did with Padilla, no man's life or family are safe, because the president, our Christian president, has suspended the right of habeas corpus. And where is the outcry? I mean, we all have to obey the law, even the president of the United States. And yet it seems that he's getting away with it because his party controls both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And it's about time that we had, you know, gridlock there so they cannot get away with this. And the president is held to the same laws that everybody else is. And he can't interpret the law any way he wants to. That's exactly what every dictator does. And people say, oh, well, you can't call the president a dictator. Well, he has to obey by the law. And when he doesn't obey by the law, and he puts in a man like Alberto Gonzalez, who will come up and say anything that he's told to say, as the Attorney General of the United States, that no man's life or property or family are safe. And I'm really very concerned. And where is the outcry from the good Christians of this country and our Christian leaders?
There must be an outcry if we're going to prevent this from happening to each one of us for holding politically incorrect views, as they would term it, or terming us terrorists when we talk about the Constitution. Well, actually, it's the people violating the Constitution that are the lawbreakers, or you could say the terrorists. It is those who are the dangerous people, not we who are desiring to follow the Constitution. Well, the third limitation on congressional authority, and by this way, this is also a limitation on states' authority, as we'll see in a moment. There's a section here that limits states from specific things. They cannot pass bills of attainder, that is, have a legislative finding of guilt. Congress cannot haul somebody in and hold a trial and pass a bill that says, oh, this person's guilty. That's not the job of Congress. That's the job of the courts. Likewise, states cannot do that either. They cannot pass ex post facto laws. That is, laws that go backwards in time and say, what was one day a legal act is no longer today a legal act, but now we're going to make it illegal when you committed that act, even though it was legal at the time. It's kind of putting you in a impossible situation because the law changes. We know they change the law every year, and if they made ex post facto law, well, You would never know when you could be arrested for some crime because they might change the law, and if they make it ex post facto, they can charge you with having committed a crime even when you did not know it was a crime because it wasn't a crime when you did that act. Likewise, they can't pass laws that raise the status of an offense from misdemeanor to felony in the past, nor increase penalties for offenses in the past, or laws that make it easier to convict, that is, changing the rules of evidence in court in the past. None of those things can be done by Congress. None of those things can be done also on the state level. Otherwise, we would not have a fair, just court system. And as we know, our court system has been corrupted severely, but these are limitations placed on Congress to prevent corruption there. Fourthly, no direct taxes may be done. That is, no taxes directly from the federal government upon the citizens. Most Americans say, what are you talking about? That's what, you know, April 15th, I pay the IRS, you know? That's federal tax. I got to pay that federal tax. They're going to come after me. Well, it's unconstitutional. It's being done. And I don't recommend you change, because you know the IRS is, has this enormous unconstitutional power that if we had right congressmen and senators, they would be stripped of those unconstitutional powers. But the direct taxes were always to be in proportion to the census, and the bill was not ever sent to the individual. It was sent to the state according to the number of people in that state. So a state that has a large population, such as Florida, would be paying a bigger tax bill than a small state like, say, Vermont. So according to the census, the proportion, the tax bill was split up. It was sent to the states. Then the states raised the revenue by whatever means they chose to pay the bill to the federal government. Fifthly, there was to be no tax or duty on items exported from states. And sixthly, no preference for local ships, ports, or over others. Seven, no money drawn from the Treasury except by appropriation of Congress with regular public accounting. Whoa, here's one that they've driven a Mack truck through. This is ridiculous. They can't even balance the budget, let alone can they account for the billions of dollars. I forget which, you know, Department of Education can't account for billions of dollars. You know, the accounting practices in the federal government are horrendous, which again is a violation here of Article 1, Section 9. And lastly, in that list of limitations, that there's no title of nobilities to be given. In other words, there's nobody to be granted special privileges because the government favors them, as was the usual case in England, where the king would knight someone, and now they got special favors and maybe special tax breaks. And none of that was to take place. Well, quickly, let's just briefly run through the limitations on state authority. States cannot enter treaties, alliances, or confederations with other countries. They cannot grant letters of marque, that is, to allow privateers to go capture vessels on the high seas during time of war. States cannot issue paper money or even coin money. And states, as we mentioned, cannot pass as bills of attainder or ex post facto laws. And the states may not pass laws impairing the obligations of contracts. Because our framers believed that the right to make and the right to enforce a contract was a God-given right. It was a sacred right. However, our evil Supreme Court in 1934 basically overruled the Constitution and said, oh, well, in the Home Building and Loan Association v. Blaisdell, that, you know, there would be a moratorium on mortgage foreclosures because it has to be, the court was saying that, the states cannot enforce contracts unreasonably. And they read, basically, the Supreme Court read the phrase unreasonably into the Constitution that was never there, never part of the original intent of our framers. Therefore, they have said the states have the authority to interfere with private business relationships, which, again, was nothing that our founders desired to take place. States may not also, without the consent of Congress, tax imports and exports, except what was minimally necessary in order to inspect things coming into the state. And then finally, states may not, without the consent of Congress, levy duty of tonnage on ships, or keep troops or ships in peacetime, make agreements or compacts with other states, or make war, except if they were invaded or in imminent danger. So those are the restrictions on state's authority, and usually we don't think of the Constitution as restricting the states, we think of it as restricting the federal government. And yet there is this list in Article 1, Section 10 of the limitations on state's authority that's also important to understand.
Well, I think it's so vitally important that our listeners study the Constitution, understand it. Really, it was the envy of the entire world. And for, 150 years, everybody looked to America for as the beacon of freedom, really the city on the hill, as it were, the hope of all mankind. This is why people from all over the world came to America, because here you could be free. The power of the central government over the lives of the people was to be limited by the chains of the Constitution. And why have we lost that dream? Why, very simply, because most people really don't understand the Constitution. David, let's get your telephone number out.
Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796.
We'll get that up again in just a moment. All right, David, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up, and then when we get to the end of the program, we'll get that that telephone number and website out again.
What we're sharing here, Dr. Stan, is really just following the outline of our course. It's a 12-part course. 12 individual lectures by Dr. John Eidsmo on DVD that anyone with any group of people can show this. All you need is a TV player and a player to show this. The student notebook is a detailed outline of the entire course content. So as people are listening to Dr. Eidsmo's lecture, they can be making their own notes to be sure they understand these vital principles. And the whole course is designed as a very turnkey program that you don't need any special education or special preparation. It helps if you've gone through the course on your own, but that's not absolutely necessary. We have test questions and review questions, all of which the host has given a detailed outline of the questions as well as the answers. That after the half-hour lecture is done, they can just simply walk their class through those materials to help them reinforce what they're learning. And that's what this is designed, is basically a civics course that really should be offered in every church in America, because our founders understood that the churches were the powerhouse. They were what motivated the war for independence. It was the flaming righteousness of the preachers from the pulpit, and that's what I believe can retake America if churches will teach these godly principles that our founders built our nation upon and give their people a working knowledge of the Constitution, the Declaration, the Bill of Rights. That's what this course does, and we encourage your listeners to purchase a host kit. They can call us and get a host kit and set up an institute on the Constitution in their church, or perhaps if they choose to do it in their neighborhood, maybe in their own home or a community center, or talk to one of the clubs in the community that offers a venue where this can be done, to train people in these principles, because in order to take our nation back from the wicked tyrants who are in control, we need millions of Americans who understand these principles and then are ready to act upon them to remove people from office who won't follow the Constitution and to replace them with people who will follow the Constitution. Our website, where people can also order the host kit, as well as there's articles and other materials that can be helpful to them in this, our website is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com, or they can call us toll-free and order a host kit and get started in their community. Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. An Institute on the Constitution, currently we have...
Hold that thought right there, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And, of course, the Institute does support Radio Liberty, and Radio Liberty supports the Institute. David, I want you to get your website and your telephone number out just one more time.
Our website's iotconline.com, and our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796.
Well, God bless you, and we'll look forward to having you back with us again next
week. Thank you.
Month.
God bless you. Dad.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our conversation with David Whitney. I know I always do, and always learn a certain amount about our Constitution. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours every day by radio and internet and shortwave and satellite, reaching people across the country. If you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters or perhaps join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, as you know, I've written a book called The Brotherhood of Darkness, which is now in its 8th or 9th printing, and we're going to have to do another printing. What you can help us if you're interested, you'd like to. First of all, the book ordinarily markets for $12.95 each, but we're offering a case of the books. That's 64 books for $149.95 plus shipping. And we hope that many of you out there in the listening audience would give serious consideration to buying a case of Brotherhood of Darkness. 64 books for $149.95. Ordinarily, they are sold at $12.95 each. You can sell them, you can give them away, you can lend them, but we want you to spread the word. And I'll tell you, this book has touched many people's lives, and we'll be only making the offer, I think, about another week. We're about halfway there to the support that we need to do our printing. Our telephone number, again, is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a case of Brotherhood of Darkness. And then, of course, we would mention you can get the video or the DVD on the Brotherhood of Darkness by calling 1-800-544-8927. We think that certainly the video, actually it's in DVD form, entitled The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. That's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. It's almost 3 hours. And it, in a very dramatic fashion, gives you the background of the secret societies that came to America. And David was just talking a few minutes ago how in the period around... I guess it was 1814 or 1816, why they were already beginning to modify the meaning of the Constitution. You have to understand the secret societies were here at that time. Why? Well, it has always been the ancient plan of the secret societies to use America's military and financial power to bring about the one world order, and that's why we're in the Middle East today. Don't be taken in by all the other explanations that are given. It's all about globalism. It's all about power. It's all about establishing that one world government that was prophesied so long ago. So please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And we'll be back shortly. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that is going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we ask you to hold your calls for the time being, unless we actually ask for calls, because we have on the line, certainly one of my favorite guests, Ellen Gunderson Traylor, and she has written, I don't know, how many books have you written, Ellen?
It's 17 now, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, it's on Ruth, and it's on Mary Magdalene. And of course, she has some stories about Israel. All of her books, of course, are biblically centered. And we carry, I think, just about every book she's written on Melchizedek, and certainly so many of the major people in the Bible that you may not even realize their significance. There's a wonderful book on Noah, what things were like at the time of the Great Flood. Anyway, thought maybe this evening we could talk about a series of... Ellen has written a couple of books. They're really modern books. They're really based upon the prophetic nature of Israel and the things that are destined to happen there. And I remember, of course, I remember one of them was called The Priest. What was the other one?
The Oracle.
The Oracle. Well, these are the stories of sort of an Indiana Jones-like character. Why don't you sort of give the background of those stories?
Well, thank you for having me on. The Priest and the Oracle are the two books I've done on current events. All of my others have been historical novels, but these are modern-day stories. In fact, on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, they're billed as international thrillers. And they do follow a character by the name of David Rothmeyer, who is based on a couple of archaeologists that I have met and interviewed over the years over in Israel. He's kind of a composite of them. And it has to do with the rebuilding of the temple in Israel, and which, of course, has not happened yet. But there are a number of movements in Israel, in Jerusalem, related to the attempt on the part of the Jews, their plans to rebuild their temple, which of course was taken down, destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. As you know, at that point, the Jews were dispersed throughout the world. That's called the diaspora, the dispersion of the Jews, and they lost their homeland. And it all through those centuries, even up till this very day, the Jews pray for the rebuilding of their temple so that Messiah can come. Of course, the Orthodox Jews do not believe that Jesus was the Messiah, so they're still looking for him. But in order for him to rule from Jerusalem, he will need a place to do that from. So that's what these stories are about, and they have a lot to do with current events right now.
And really, they're fascinating. It's the wonderful, wonderful stories. But, of course, it's biblical-based. And the thing about Ellen is she goes to these areas. She does a tremendous amount of research, historical and personal research. So her stories really come alive. And whether it be the story of Mary Magdalene or the story of Noah. But as far as I'm concerned, I love these stories. In fact, Ellen is in the process of coming up with a third in the series, The Priest, The Oracle, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that when we get back here. But this has so much to do with what's really going on today, because a lot of things going on in the Middle East don't make any sense unless you understand their prophetic nature. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, Alan Gunderson trainer. Why don't you sort of pick the thought up? I mean, sometimes when you read the news, you have the feeling that if you didn't have any idea what the prophecies were all about, that so much of what's happened and the historical events that led up to the establishment, reestablishment of the nation of Israel, none of these things would have happened.
That's right. And one of the things that I point out in the introduction to my books is that I hope that the readers are paying attention to the news every day, because if they are, that they will see that the scenarios in these books are confirmed on a daily basis in the news. These books were written a few years ago. The Priest came out in 98 and the Oracle in 2001, just a few months before the attack on the World Trade Center. But, you know, when that attack happened, Dr. Stan, I was absolutely deluged with emails from my readers asking me, how did I know that this would happen? Well, I did not write about an attack like that, but I did write about the inevitability of moves against the Western world on the part of Islam, and I did tie in what had already happened at the World Trade Center in 1990 with and also in 93. You may recall in 1990 Meir Kahane, who was the leader of the Zionist Jews in New York City, was assassinated, and he was killed by the same people who attempted to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And then ultimately, of course, those people were connected with those who did finally destroy the World Trade Center.
And, of course, they were also tied into Oklahoma City, too, weren't they?
Yes. Well, yes. And so because I had hinted at these things in the books, people were, you know, wanting to know, how did I know these things? And like I say, I didn't foretell that particular kind of a devastation, but, you know, the attempt had been made before in 1993. And so I did have that in the story, and I talked about, you know, what was behind that. And, you know, to this day, Dr. Stan, it has not really come forth very clearly in the media just why the World Trade Center would have been the target. You know, there have been various theories. Well, they were the tallest buildings in the world.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment.
Okay.
With Ellen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ellen has been simply telling us that after, you know, the attack on the World Trade Center came, so many of the people who'd read her books emailed her and wanted to know how she knew it was going to happen, because she'd talked about the attack on Meir Kahane back in 1990. He was the led the Zionist Jews in New York, and he was killed by the same people who tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And then, of course, if you read her books, you'll find that there's a tie-in to certainly she had an opportunity of talking to the lawyer who defended Timothy McVeigh that dealt with the Oklahoma City bombing in 1996. And she began to realize, of course, this relationship between the radical movements in this country and the Islamic terrorists in this country. So so she was expecting there would be these attacks on the United States, and they're prophesied in her books. And of course, the second book came out, The Oracle, came out in 2001, before the World Trade Center bombing. And I've been waiting ever since 2001 for the next book, and apparently it's in the it's on the way very shortly.
It's in the works. I am well into it, and as I have explained before on your program, when that attack happened, I needed time to kind of reconnoiter and digest all of that, and then take a while to see where things were going before I moved directly into the next book. But I already had the framework of the story in mind. But anyway, as I was saying, there have been various theories as to why the World Trade Center would have been attacked. But I have my own theory, and I did bring it out in these books, and I bounced it off Stephen Jones, who was Timothy McVeigh's attorney, and you know, he seemed to be quite collaborative with me on that. Would you like to hear my theory?
Yes, you go right ahead.
Okay. Well, my theory is that it was not because they were the tallest buildings in the world, or that because it was New York City in particular, which is so important to our country. But actually, and it wasn't an attack so much on the Western world, which is what we've been hearing, isn't it? That it was an attack against the Western culture. My belief is that even more important than those theories, and those are have their place, but is that it was the headquarters of world Zionism, the headquarters of all the wealth of the Zionist Jews in the world, was headquartered in the World Trade Center. What this was, Dr. Stan, in my opinion, was an attack on Israel. The Jewish people, and particularly the Temple movement. Israel and the Temple movement had its sponsors in the World Trade Center. And one good reason to take it down would be to short-circuit that flow of funds going to Israel, and some of which was going into the Temple movement.
All right, fine. And so this takes us back to what is happening in Israel. And this is the most amazing story. I mean, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. The Jewish people were dispersed throughout the world. And now, at this time in history, they've suddenly gone back to Israel. And, of course, they prevailed.
No.
But I don't believe that there was an earthly way, do you?
No, it was not an earthly thing. It is it's a divine intervention. And that is not to say that all Jews are righteous, or that Israel is always right in everything it does. What it does say is that God had a foreordained plan for Israel. It was prophesied time and time again in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that Israel, God had not forgotten his people, his chosen people, and that he would bring them back into the land again. And this, of course, is what happened in 1948. It was an outgrowth of the Holocaust in Europe, where Hitler thought he had squashed the Jews forever, but instead they rose from the ashes. And not only individuals survived, but they founded a land and a country again, which, as you say, had been dormant for 2,000 years. What other society has managed to keep its language and its traditions and its culture intact when they were dispersed all over the entire world for 2,000 years? It is an unheard of story, except for the story of Israel.
And, of course, the things that you bring out in your book, the fact that the Jewish leaders, the Jewish priests, have always felt that they wanted to have somebody of the direct lineage of the original Jewish priests. And they want to tell a little bit about that, because they actually, the only way that they could tell who the right people were was with DNA that was available now, that had never been available until this time in history.
Right.
That's such a fascinating story. Would you like to develop those ideas?
Yes. Just a few years ago, a man was sitting in a synagogue, a Jewish man was sitting in a synagogue, and he was observing the Cohen males, who the Cohens are the keepers of the priesthood of Israel, and the Levites, of course, are also the keepers of the priesthood. The Cohens are the ones from whom the high priest of Israel would come, and the name Cohen, Dr. Stan, is like the name Smith in English. It is so common. They say there are as many Cohens in New York City as there are bagels in the bakery. And so who's to say that, you know, which one of these would be the heir to the high priesthood of Israel? Well, this particular man happened to be a genetic scientist. And he came up with an idea. He knew that if you took the saliva of an individual, you could test it for various chromosomal points and so forth, and the DNA. And so he actually began a scientific study. He and a cohort of his began a scientific study. They went all over the world, and they collected saliva samples from people who claimed to be of the Cohen lineage. Now, incredibly, there were black people in Africa. There were people in Ireland. There were people in Taiwan. I mean, we're talking, this cuts across racial and cultural barriers entirely. But these people had some strain of family history that told them that they were of this background. Well, so he decided to follow this thing through, and he collected all these samples and studied them and found that in the vast number of cases, these people had a specific genetic marker in their chromosomes, which was unique to the Cohen lineage. He took Cohen, people who, there was no doubt of their Cohen lineage. It went back and back throughout their family history. No doubt they were of the Cohen lineage. He discovered they all had this marker, and then he studied these others who you would think would not even be Jews, let alone Cohens, and found that indeed many of them also had this same marker. And so what he found here was that the Cohen lineage has been kept remarkably untainted down through 4,000 years, 3,500 years of history from the time of Moses on. So we're going back three and a half centuries, okay? And so then it's just a step from there, Dr. Stan, taking genealogies, taking studies of names and tracing them back through etymology, taking all kinds of scientific studies and bringing them together. At some point, you could actually narrow the field down and ultimately designate that one person who would be the ultimate high priest of Israel. Now, why is this important? Because without the high priest of Israel, you cannot, even if you have a temple, you won't be able to conduct anything in it. So here, all of a sudden, in the 21st century, the end of the 20th century, we have all these things coming together. We have the nation of Israel founded. We have these DNA capabilities, which we've never had before. We have movements in Israel rebuilding, getting ready to rebuild the temple, which has been prophesied. We have the implements, the harps, the vestments, all these things being designed and planned and built right now for that ultimate temple. And why is that important to us as Christians? Because we know that Jesus Christ, when he returns as the Messiah, will reign from that temple.
But before that, of course, somebody else will reign there, won't they?
They will.
And this is the thing. You see, the Jews are waiting for the return of their Messiah. They're going to be misled that their Messiah is. But he's not. He's going to be the Antichrist.
That's right.
And in a similar manner, the Muslims wait for the return of the Mahdi, and they believe that he is going to be the great ruler. The Hindu waits for the return of Maitreya. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Christian waits for the return of Jesus Christ, the one true God. And really, what an exciting time, because we see all of these various things fitting together. There are people in Iran today who want to bring on a world chaos so the Mahdi can return.
Right.
And bring us all under their control. Well, why don't you just pick up this story there? Certainly, the group, they call them the Temple Mount Group, and you sort of weave their story into your books, don't you?
Well, they're My agency and my book is called the Temple Consortium, and it is based on a group, an actual group in Jerusalem today called the Temple Institute. There is another group called the Temple Mount Faithful, and yet others, but the most scholarly, really, of them all, and the ones which have put the most financial backing into all of this is the Temple Institute. And the rabbis in my books are based on people that I actually met there at the Temple Institute. All of my characters in my books have their roots in adventures that I myself had going across the world studying for this and meeting people and interviewing them. I had many great adventures, and actually I was even followed quite a bit of the time, particularly when we were in Germany and England, and you know, I had so many contacts with various rather controversial characters that I'm sure the powers that be, you know, that watch these things were well aware of my activities. And my husband and I were definitely under surveillance as we traveled through Europe and England.
Well, do you think you were under the surveillance by the Mossad or what?
No, you know, it mainly took place in England. I think it did happen in Germany, but I think it was all connected. And we have talked to a number of people since that happened, and they've given us their ideas of who it really was. But we had hooked up with the head of B'nai B'ris in London, and from that point on, we were definitely being tracked. And I think what happened was that B'nai B'ris, along with the British intelligence, was watching us very carefully. We were asking a lot of very, very sensitive questions. I had been emailing for months across the world, and making phone calls, having phone conversations with, you know, a lot of sensitive characters, both in the United States and elsewhere. And I think, knowing what I do about Interpol, you can only do so much of that before it gets picked up on.
Well, of course, the thing is that British intelligence, as American intelligence, has a strong tie into the occult, who would be very, very interested and very concerned about too much coming out of the truth about what's really going on behind the scenes.
Well, I could tell you some very spine-tingling stories about our adventures, but just to give you an example, in London, every day when we would come back to our hotel, the locks had been changed on the door, and we had to go down to the main desk and get somebody to come up and reprogram the entrance to our door. You know, it had the...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, Ellen has been saying that when she and her husband were traveling in Europe, and they were, of course, been doing a lot of research for her books, and actually, of course, she and her husband were followed in England and presumably in Germany as well. And certainly she thinks it's tied into British intelligence, and I would certainly concur, knowing what I do, that there are elements within British intelligence going all the way back to into the 1500s, in the time of Bloody Mary, Queen Mary, and Francis Bacon. Elements of the British intelligence were involved in the occult. They still are, as with certain elements within our own intelligence agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency. There really are these occult forces out there who are very aware of the spiritual implications of everything going on in the world today, because behind everything happening politically and militarily and educationally and culturally are these occult forces. Would you agree with that?
Oh, well, everything goes back to good and evil, doesn't it?
It sure does.
And But, you know, even if it weren't an actual occult thing, it was definitely a politically sensitive situation that we were involved in. And I'm not saying that it wasn't connected to the occult as far as those who were concerned about what we were doing. But I am saying, even if it wasn't involved with that, the things that we were dealing with were getting at issues that were so sensitive. When I spoke with Stephen Jones for 3 hours face-to-face one day...
Now, for our listeners, Stephen Jones was Timothy McVeigh's attorney. Go ahead.
Yes. He told me that he could not tell me anything, but he said, you tell me what you think, and I will tell you yes or no. And so for 3 hours, I gave him my theories, which were going to be woven into my books. And he would sit there and say, yes, 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 yes. You have it. Yes, you have it. So we know that his life, the life of his family, was threatened repeatedly. He was in a very sensitive situation there.
And, of course, what he had really uncovered was the relationship between the radical militia groups in America and the Islamic terrorists. Would that be a fair statement?
That and the FBI.
Right.
Remember when 5,000 pages of material were just accidentally misplaced in the courtroom?
Right. And of course...
And that was material that the FBI did not want to come to light.
Well, they don't dare let the American people know the truth about what really happened with Oklahoma City bombing, what happened at Waco, what happened with the downing of TW-800,
right.
And certainly never to know what really happened on the morning of September 11th.
Right, right. Well, anyway, as I'm kind of getting off the track of our original subject, I guess, but I don't think I had ever told you this, had I?
No, you haven't.
That my husband and I were... track that way, and spine tingling. We at the time, to be quite frank, we didn't really know what was going on. I mean, it's like it took a while to sink in. But I can remember one evening when we got back to our hotel and we couldn't get in again because supposedly something had happened to the locks. It was one of these digital lock things, you know, that you had to use a card on. When we got in there, I just had this feeling that things were not the way we had left them. And I could not lay my finger on it, but I just knew that our bags, the things that we had left lying around, were not quite the way we had left them. And my husband and I decided then and there that we would not discuss anything to do with my research in the room. But the next day, when we went out, everywhere we went, from the moment we stepped out of the hotel until sunset when we headed back to the hotel, the same pair of very peculiar-looking people showed up at every single place we went to. I mean, these were very unusual-looking man and woman. They stood out like sore thumbs, and we've been told since then that that was on purpose.
That's to intimidate you.
Yes, so that we would realize we were being followed. Mm. And we tested it at one point. We were standing outside the Tower of London, and I turned, they were sitting over on a bench, and I said, Dick, I'm going to pretend I'm taking a picture of the London Bridge, and I'm going to turn and take one of them. And as I turned, they were gone. And then we said, okay, we're going to walk over and try to find Shakespeare's Globe Theater. It was about four bridges down. It took about an hour to get there, and when we got there, they were sitting on a bench right outside the Globe Theater.
We'll be back in just a moment with Ellen Gunderson Taylor. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this may sound rather dramatic, but this sort of thing does happen. Of course, what Ellen was doing, they were beginning to try to understand all the things that were going to have to be necessary before the sacrifices could begin on Temple Mount. Now, to actually have the temple, the sacrifices there, they're going to have to build a tabernacle, and some people think they're going to have to destroy the Dome of the Rock, this beautiful Muslim church that was written there, a mosque that was built there, you know, in the late 600s. But under any circumstances, before they can begin doing that, they have to have the ashes of the red heifer. And you actually analyzed each one of the things that would be necessary. And there are not that many things once they know who the priest is. Mm-hmm. They probably know exactly where the Ark of the Covenant is. Mm-hmm. But what about the ashes of the red heifer? Why is that important?
Well, that's my second book, The Oracle. In the first book, they're looking for the legitimate heir to the high priesthood, and David Rossmeyer, being a linguistic archaeologist, is enlisted to track down the genealogy and the DNA and so forth to locate the high priest. In The Oracle, he is looking for the implements necessary for the high priest to do his duties, which would be the ashes of the red heifer and the Urim and Thummim, which would be a device called the which I call the Oracle. It's a device which can supposedly interpret the will of God. So again, he takes off on a globe hopping journey, and these books weave several stories together in one, don't they, Dr. Stan?
Yes, they do, and you do that so well, you know, all these various stories, and then the end of the book, they all come together.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, it's called a convergent novel, for those of you who like to study literature, but it takes all these different strands of story. And in the case of The Oracle, we're weaving together a number of interesting scenarios, and the same in The Priest. In both of them, we have an old Irish Catholic priest who teaches at Oxford and who has kept a secret for 40 years. Only he knows where this thing is, and it is the final key to the genealogy of the high priest, and I won't tell you what that is right now. And in the second one, we have some characters in Montana who get involved with people in...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ellison is simply going into the background of how these stories weave together, the convergence novels. In other words, there are three or four different storylines, and they all come together in the end. But, of course, the story deals, the first book, which is The Priest, deals with David Rothmeyer trying to track down the priest, the man who will be the high priest. And actually, this sort of thing has really gone on. It wasn't David Rothmeyer, because he's a fictional character, but there really has this been a desire to find the man who will be the high priest when they begin the sacrifices there in the temple. And then of course, with the second a book, it's called The Oracle, and it's the effort to find the ashes of the red heifer. You have to have an unblemished red heifer, and if you can find one today, fine, or you have to have the ashes of the last red heifer that was sacrificed, and we're going back almost 2,000 years. And then, of course, The Oracle, which is something that allows people to know the will of God. So pick up the story there.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, in these books you have these diverse characters who don't seem to be connected until you really get into it, and then you find that they're all woven together. But we hop from Montana to Columbus, Ohio. We have a bunch of bikers chasing after a Jewish girl who has one of the keys to all this. You know, it sounds, when I talk about it, like so much hodgepodge and really just ridiculously complex, but you know, really, that's the way it is when you set out to piece the truth together. It takes you into all kinds of places, and you meet all kinds of people that you never dreamed you would ever need to talk to.
And, of course, really, they're fascinating adventure novels. They're the sort of novels you just don't want to put down. And, you know, people talk about the Da Vinci Code. These are every bit as exciting as Dan Brown's book, only these are based upon biblical truth, not the effort to destroy Christianity, which was Dan Brown's goal. In fact, I think these would make wonderful, wonderful movies.
Well, I should tell you right now, I will ask for your prayers. One of my books is in the hands of a producer who made the two biggest selling movies of all time. He made Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And he has Noah right now.
Really?
Yep.
I would think he'd be more interested in the priest.
Well, maybe we'll have to give that to him next. But anyway, he has Noah. But that's aside from what we're talking about. Yeah, I'd love to see these made into films. I think they... Well, you know, did you see National Treasure?
Yes,
Is this, you know, that has some of the same flavor to it. But it's not based on truth at all, whereas these are. So... do you want to hear about the third one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, the third one is called The Cornerstone. And in this one, David Rothmeyer is enlisted to figure out where the temple actually stood on Mount Moriah.
And, of course, if you've ever been to Mount Moriah, this probably would have a lot more meaning to you because, of course, the golden doors there, and it's prophesied that they would never be opened until Christ would come through them. And they've been sealed shut for, what, all these thousands of years?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Arabs sealed them shut, the Muslims, under Suleiman, believing that they could keep the Messiah out just by filling them in. And then they put a graveyard in front of them, believing that the Messiah would never walk through a graveyard. But what they failed to account for was the resurrection. But anyway, yes, they thought they could keep Messiah out, but they will not keep him out. He'll come through the eastern gate and he'll take his place in the temple.
Right, because in the meantime, why, they're going to have to get the temple built. And the question then is, where on the Mount Moriah will the temple go?
Well, and the reason that is so important and so sensitive is because the Dome of the Rock is up there. Al-Aqsa Mosque is there. And that is Arab territory. That's an Arab sanctuary. Of course, they believe that Muhammad took his night ride to heaven on that, from that rock that's under the dome. But we know that that rock was part of the, well, it was the original threshing floor that King David bought to build the temple on. And so the courtyard actually contained that rock, and very likely the sacrifices were made there.
And, of course, that was supposedly where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac.
Right, exactly. That was the original spot, and also Jacob had his dream there. That was the rock that he made his pillow and slept on, and a pillow in the... In the Near East is a big couch. It's not just something under your head. But he slept on that rock and had his dream of the ladder stretching to heaven. Moriah, by the way, means wisdom teacher, teacher of wisdom. So if we can get a grasp on how important that location is in the mind of God and what it really means in his economy and in his purposes in the world, then we begin to become wise. Our eyes are opened to the purposes of God in the world when we start to understand his purposes with Israel. And his purposes with Israel center on that holy place. When Jacob awoke from his dream there, he said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Surely this is the gate of heaven." So he had actually seen the gate of heaven and the angels coming and going between earth and heaven right there. So that it's a very deep and very profound thing we're talking about here, and that's why Satan is so anxious to keep it under his own control.
And of course, the thing, the implications of what we're really talking about, we're talking about people, Jewish rabbis, who are actually planning on rebuilding the ancient temple that was destroyed in 70 AD. And they're getting, they have all the implements together. Have they got the ashes, the red heifer yet?
No, they don't have that yet.
But they're looking. They're looking all over the world for an unblemished red heifer without one gray hair or anything on it.
And also they're looking for the original ashes. They need one or the other, like you said. If they can't find the original ashes, and we really haven't explained what these ashes were used for.
Why don't you explain why?
Moses in Leviticus talks about how the priest would purify himself so that he could go in and offer atonement for the people. And the way he was purified and the way the implements of the sacrifices were purified was by having water mixed with the ashes of this red cow sprinkled on them. That was the purification. I don't know what you'd say there. There probably wasn't a chemistry that happened, but, you know, it was an act of obedience on the part of the people to follow what God told them to do. And this is what God said would be the ritual purification of the priest. So now that the original red heifer's ashes were kept in an urn, and as they would begin to dissipate and they'd get down where there wasn't much left, they would kill another cow. Didn't have to be a pure red one, but just another cow, and sprinkle it with the ashes. So then its ashes were considered pure, okay? So you had the original ashes being used to sprinkle the next cow, and then its ashes and so on being used. In the time of Jeremiah, when the Babylonians were getting ready to invade, Jeremiah is the last one who mentions, who seems to have had the ashes of the red heifer. And we don't know what he did with them. If that could be discovered, and that's what my book, The Oracle, is partly about, is what did Jeremiah do with the ashes? Where did he take them? Where did they end up? There are a lot of theories about that. If they could be found, that would solve the problem. In the meanwhile, if in case they're never found, the other alternative is to find another pure red heifer with only no more than 3 white hairs on it. And they have thought they found it a few times. There was one in Texas, there was one in Sweden, but it always ended up that they were not.
And then, of course, the other thing is the Ark of the Covenant. Don't they have to have the Ark of the Covenant?
That seems to be somewhat debatable as to whether they'll actually have to have the Ark of the Covenant or not. I think they would. I don't know why they wouldn't, because in the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, part of it was the mercy seat, where the Shekinah glory of God would come and settle on that. So I believe that they would have to have the Ark of the Covenant, and there are different theories as to where it might be. I did not go into that in either of my books because it's been done to death. You know, there have been so many stories written about it in movies, and you know, I didn't go into the Ark of the Covenant. But there are some various stories about where it might be.
Well, of course, some people think it's in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians think it's in Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are other people who think it's hidden in a cave not too far from Jeremiah's grotto.
And possibly underneath the Well of Souls, or the Well of the Spirits. No, excuse me, the Dome of the Spirits on Mount Moriah.
Okay, and so that these are things that, of course, the Jews spend full time studying
right.
and preparation. I mean, they're the people who've been working at this literally for dozens of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they are all prepared. They feel the time is very close, don't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But see, if you go to Israel today and you talk to these people and you talk to anybody over there in the know on this, they will say that the moment we set foot on Temple Mount to do this, World War III will break out.
Well, of course, the thing is, what I think most people do not understand, there are people within the Iranian government. One of them, I believe, is the current president, Ahmadinejad.
Right.
And I think he wants to bring about World War III. This is why he's doing everything that is totally irrational. I mean, saying that the Holocaust didn't take place, we've got to wipe Israel off the face of the world, we've got to move Israel to Europe, we're going to go ahead and develop our nuclear material, and we're not going to work with the Russians, we're going to do it our way. And it's almost as if he is intentionally doing everything he can to inflame the Israelis and the Americans to precipitate an attack on his country, which could very well precipitate World War III.
Well, he knows that the Israeli weapons are poised right at him, and that they would not hesitate to do a preemptory strike. According to things that I have read and which you have in fact shown me and sent to me, they believe that this 12th Imam will not reveal himself until there is a cosmic chaos and war and a huge confrontation between good and evil, and then he will usher in an era of universal peace. But in order for him to come, there has to be war first.
And, of course, the 12th Imam is really the Mahdi, the returning of the,
right.
the prophet.
Right, uh-huh. And he's been in hiding since the 9th century, supposedly. They're just waiting for him to come back. But they're trying to help him out by creating this, by baiting the rest of the world.
Isn't that really the most incredible story?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that just before you called, and to me it's the fulfillment of Genesis 16:12, which says, Ishmael shall be a wild man, his hand against every man, and every man's hand against him. Never before in history has there been this possibility, this potential, that one race of people, being the Arab people descended from Ishmael, would actually have the capacity to be have their hand against everybody else on earth. And doesn't that sound like what they've been doing for the past few years? You know, New York City wasn't the only place that was hit. There was Barcelona, there was they've been acting up in London, in Russia, the Philippines, the Sudan, Pakistan. I mean, this is all over the world.
Sure, Jordan.
They're attempting to stir up trouble everywhere against people who've never even been their enemies. Well, and this is the only time in history when that prophecy has the potential of being fulfilled.
Well, I think that we are living, Helen, in some of the most exciting times in history. And really what a privilege it is, at least to have a glimpse of what's going on. We don't have all the answers, but all the answers really are there in the scriptures. It's just a matter of piecing them together, and you've done such a wonderful job in your books. I should tell our listeners, we do carry both The Priest and The Oracle, and if you haven't read Ellen's books, you really missed a treat. Certainly my wife has read all of them, my secretary has read all of them. I've read most of them because I have to read them before I do the interviews, and I always enjoy them, and they're most wonderful. Biblical ones based on the Bible are just taking the scriptures and studying the scriptures, and then, of course, taking a little bit of literary license to make the story come together. But they're really fascinating books. If you'd like to know more about them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We're talking about the Priest and the Oracle. Those are two more modern books, but the rest of them are really all based upon biblical characters, and they all come alive. Ellen has a wonderful gift. Certain people have a gift of writing novels, and these are wonderful, wonderful novels. I know my wife is one of your greatest admirers.
Well, thank you. I'd like to just, if I have a moment, I don't know how we're doing time-wise, mention one incident that happened about a month ago that was really like taken from one of the books.
Go ahead.
Do you remember in Toledo, Ohio, when they unearthed a cell of Al-Qaeda members?
Right.
Okay. In The Priest, we have a cell of I didn't call them Al-Qaeda, but I called them jihadists, located in western Montana. And, you know, I have said all along that the Elohim City Bunch, where Timothy McVeigh was groomed, was all tied in with Al-Qaeda in the Philippines.
Hold, we'll be back in just a moment here. 1-800-544-8927. Why did you pick up the story there, Ellen?
Well, we know that the people of Elohim City, where Timothy McVeigh and his cohort, what was it, Terry Nichols, were groomed.
This was a Christian Identity Center there, and a center run by Reverend Millard there, and what was that, in Oklahoma, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, right. In Oklahoma, right. And anyway, they were trained by a guerrilla warfare teacher, a German, and I patterned one of my characters in The Priest after him.
Andy Strassmeyer.
Yes. You remembered. Okay. Anyway, he was originally training Al-Qaeda in the Philippines, Dr. Stan.
I didn't know that, but yes. That wouldn't be a total surprise. He was obviously in German intelligence. So.
Yes. Yeah, and I didn't tell you about being followed in Germany, but that's a whole other story. But So anyway, yes, this cell in Toledo is just one of many, 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 many which will be found, and they will find that they are tied in with Aryan Nations groups around the country.
Now, what you're suggesting then is that the Islamic terrorists are working with the Aryan Nation groups. In other words, you have these two groups, one the radical so-called right, and the other, I don't know if you want to call them radical left, call them what you will. All of these revolutionary groups based upon hatred of America interlocked, and we see this in South America where Hugo Chavez, who's a dedicated Marxist, is working with the Iranian militants.
And some of Sinn Féin and the Irish revolutionaries,
right,
are somewhat tied in. Terror is terror, and these people help each other.
They sure do.
One of the things that the Irish revolutionaries have in common with the Arab people and with the Aryan Nations people is the hatred of Israel, hatred of the Jews, and this goes clear back into the Middle Ages. This is one thing that I really try to bring out in my books, is that radical Islam and radical freedom movement here in this country are in cahoots, at least on one thing, not only hatred of the American government, but hatred of Israel. And they support one another in endeavors that attempt to bring Israel down.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Ellen Gundersen Traylor, and she's just pointing out that the radical militant, the militia groups here, and anti-Semitic groups are certainly working in league with the Islamic terrorists because of a common hatred of Israel, and they all want to destroy Israel. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, definitely, yes, absolute anti-Semitism.
And it's growing all across America. That's unfortunately, but it's a reality that we have to face.
Well, we have to figure that Hitler, you know, he's the forefather, at least in the Western world, of the Nazi movement. And then you have people like this Muhammad, I don't have it in front of me, Ahmadinejad.
Ahmadinejad, right.
Yeah, the president of Iran, you know, who, I mean, he almost looks like Hitler, you know. He swaggers like him, he talks like him, he gestures like him. And, you know, this is nothing new. In the story of Esther, Haman was just like that.
Hey, you know, we could go on for an hour, but we're out of time.
Oh,
it's been
okay.
Such a great pleasure. Can I really call you and get you onto some of our other programs? Maybe we could do a program some evening where we could take the full 2 hours, if you wouldn't mind.
This is fun. I really enjoy it, and you know I'm always happy to help out. May I give my website?
You please do.
Okay. It's very simple, ellentraylor.com. That's ellentraylor, all one word, .com.
And Ellen's books are wonderful. And so anyway, ellentraylor.com. God bless you. We'll be talking to you later.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. That was Ellen Gundersen Traylor, and certainly one of my favorite authors. I hope she'll become one of yours. If you'd like to know more about her books, I think we carry all of them. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We were talking primarily tonight about the priest and the oracle. And if you enjoyed, you know, the Da Vinci Code, you'll love these books. These are fast-moving adventure novels that are never going to get the play that the others will. Why? Because they're Christian novels. They're written from a Christian perspective. And, of course, they will certainly bring you into a closer personal relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ. So let me recommend the books to you. Fascinating. All of Ellen's books are wonderful. In fact, we really should get Ellen on a more regular basis. Certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope yours as well. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really depend on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every weekday, and then we do our weekend programs as well. And we spend our time full-time trying to educate the American people about this spiritual battle in which we're engaged. And if you'd like to help us, join the Radio Liberty family. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call. Our February newsletter will give you some real insight into the war on terrorism. At least, well, that's what they call it, a war on terrorism. But is it really a war on terrorism, or is there another agenda? Our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. And, of course, then, please pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till we're together again, may the Lord be with you.